preaching has changed, and the apparent criticism of a large number of people towards preaching, and it's very difficult to get the honest opinion of people. This book over here, The Comfortable Pew, is probably the most severe criticism of preaching that you can possibly find. There's a book published in England called God's Frozen People, and this is a criticism of the laity, and that they do not participate in the activities of the church as they should. But of course they blame the clergy for wanting it to be that way, that they want to run the show and they don't want the laity to participate. There are other books, as you know, and other criticisms. Harvey Cox is one of the most vociferous, and that attorney Stringfellow. Have any of you ever heard or met Stringfellow, the attorney? Have you heard him? Quite an unusual personality. I was on a program with him in Green Lake, Wisconsin, and there he really did hammer the clergy and the tendency on the part of us to be a comfortable people. He was severely critical of the organized church and its present structure. So much so that you felt that this was the string he was strumming all the time, and you get an uneasy feeling that he was wasting considerable talent and effort in the wrong direction. We, all of us, are fully aware the world in which we're living isn't the world it was when I began my ministry. Totally different. Actually, it's much harder to be a minister today than it was when I began in 1923. That's a long time ago. And I began in 1923 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. My work was confined primarily to the work of the church: Sunday school, confirmation, Bible class, Sunday services, and we had a service in midweek, and of course the Women's Guild, Brotherhood, but there was no such thing as radio. We didn't get radio until the fourth year I was in the ministry, and of course no such thing as TV. And automobiles are put up in November and December because of the weather, and then not used again. They're put up on blocks, not used again until Easter time or thereabouts. Travel was very limited. It was very easy to get an audience for almost anything because people were anxious to get out and go places. And of course, we ministers labored under the illusion they came to hear us preach. And that it was the people we had were devout. Another strong force in those days was nationalism. It lingers in some areas today. Norwegians in my community of Eau Claire, there was a large German Lutheran church and a large Norwegian Lutheran, and the immigrants gravitated to these churches, and in these churches they had their customs, their practices, which are foreign. I remember in the first Lutheran church in Eau Claire, not the one I served, but they had a Norwegian Luther League. Young people speaking Norwegian. The 18, 19-year-old kids speaking Norwegian. This was a strong tie that bound the people together. And I can remember when one family, young family, came and joined my church. The parents of the daughter said, I'd rather they'd go and join the Catholic Church than come home and join that English Lutheran Church. So strong was this nationalistic feeling. That was a powerful force in those days. This, of course, had its effect upon us theologically. We had theology to defend our nationalism. We had a way of justifying the circle in which we moved. And I presume this is true of all groups, Danish, Norwegian, German, French, whatever group you wish to go into, the national tie is powerful. Little by little, our sin has been emerging. And I can remember hearing L.W. Bow, who said to me once years ago that he was the president of St. Paul College and a leader in cooperation among Lutherans. Someone in the group had criticized the LCA. And he said, when our church, then the Norwegian Lutheran Church, emerges from its nationalistic background and has arrived and become an American church, I will be pleased if it retains as much of its Lutheran character as the LCA has. He said, we are in no position to criticize it because we have yet to emerge. I thought that was an interesting comment to make. This has been a powerful force within, I think, within the Lutheran Church, these nationalistic ties. I am of Norwegian descent. My parents both came from Norway. I speak Norwegian. The customs practices of the Norwegian people born, bred inside me. I talk Norwegian quite a bit. I was the only one not to be confirmed in Norwegian in my family. So you see how strong these ties are. My father very seldom, if ever, went to church and had no time for church or religion. But he would go if there was a Norwegian program. This, I think, is true of many churches. Oh, I think of Kretzmann, whom I know very well, Adelbert, in Chicago. He holds a German service every Sunday morning. And he makes no bones about telling you that these are the fellows that finance the church. He only has a small group there, but he has a large English service, but I mean that he caters to this nationalistic tendency on the part of all of us. This has been a strong influence. Well, that was one thing way back in those days. So it was in many ways much easier to be a preacher. You had the weight of nationalism, you had the weight of, or you had the outside influences shut off, and you could do your work without too much interruption. There was no counseling. As we speak, it was counseling today. Very, very little. Somebody would come to you about some question about the Bible or discuss some matter, but never was there any family troubles of any significance that came to you. We were not supposed to know anything about it anyhow. And there was no counseling a child of his problems. Maybe it's a different world, but at least there was no such thing as counseling. I was shaken up when I was in the ministry a couple of years, which brought me into looking at counseling. There was a girl in the church who was caught shoplifting in one of our department stores. And when they caught her, she ran to the bridge and leaped over, intending to commit suicide. But she did not succeed in taking her life and broke both her legs. She was put in the hospital, and I called on her for a number of weeks. Got to know her, I thought, quite well. Visited with her, went through the usual procedure we did as ministers then, read from the Bible, offered a prayer, wished her well, and smiled sweetly, and went each day, and then went on my way. Well, after about 2 months she was to be released, I visited with her and I said, "Now, I know you'll be welcome back in high school. The boys and girls that know you know all about what happened, but you'll see that they're friends. Don't be afraid." I said, "You're welcome home. Now the past is past, and if you'll cooperate, we'll help you." She was very pleasant and said that's what she wanted to do. And when she got home the next day, she shot herself, committed suicide. It shook me up because I thought I had reached her, and I hadn't. And that started me to look at pastoral psychiatry and reading up on that subject. But that's one field we knew nothing about in that time. I remember being called at the seminary to talk on, my knowledge is exceedingly limited about it, but still I was called to our seminary to speak on this, just the subject of counseling. It's a whole area that didn't exist, in my opinion. Then too, the minister was kind of set apart in the days gone by. He spoke as of God. He was the authority on everything. One of the reasons was he was the man in the community who was best educated as a rule. He was usually the man who had been to college and university and had a much better education, including the minister's wife, than probably 9/10 of the people in the community. So therefore he had the respect on that ground for no other reason. I can remember, every minister is a sucker in this area. I can remember a man coming to me and selling me an encyclopedia. I suppose all ministers have these kind of encyclopedias. I bought this encyclopedia. He said, Pastor, you are probably the most important person in the community. And he said, the weight of your opinion would sell the and lift the intellectual level of the community. Well, boy, by that time I'd bought the Brooklyn Bridge. I bought the encyclopedia, and it wasn't worth 80 cents. I paid $80, which is no small sum then. But I kept it on my shelves, and whenever I was tempted to be a sucker again, all I needed was look at that. It saved me lots of money. But I presume every minister's gone through that. But the man had a measure of truth in it, that the minister was highly regarded. That isn't true anymore. A friend of mine at Madison, Wisconsin, Pastor Borkert, told me the other day that he had 119 members of his church who had PhDs. This is, of course, the University of Wisconsin area. But today, the minister can't be an authority in every area. In one way, it is a good thing. It forces us to be an authority in the area of being preachers and not to be an authority in all these different areas. This little illustration I give you applies not only to preachers, but also to the subject of the Christian religion. Bishop Fjellbu of Norway preached for me once in Minneapolis at Central Lutheran, and he used an illustration I never forgot. He said he was going up the coast of Norway, and he talked to the pilot on the ship and said, "How long have you been a pilot?" He said, 25 years. And he said to the pilot, "I suppose you know every rock and shoal and current along the coast." "No," he said, "I don't." He said, "And I don't have to. All," he said, "I need to know is where the ship will float, and I know that." And so it is with us ministers. We don't need to know everything. All there's about philosophy, and all there's about science, and all there's about art, we've got to know where the soul will float. And so it is with the members of our congregation. They don't need to know everything about Bultmann or Robinson's philosophy, Altizer, and all the rest of them. Though it's in our area to know these things, but the members don't. But I think sometimes we ministers have spread ourselves too thin. Well, what does the man sitting in the pew, as he looks up at the pastor up there in the pulpit, what does he expect of him? What does he want him to be? What does he hope he will be? There's an excellent passage in 1 Samuel, the 9th chapter, the 6th verse, that describes it perfectly. Listen to this. "There is a man of God in this city. He is an honorable man. All that he says comes true. Let us go and see him. Perhaps he can help us upon our journey." Did you ever find a better passage than that? He is a man of God, not a man of science, not a man of literature, not a man of architecture, but he is a man of God. He is an honorable man. How important that is for us in the community in which we live, to be honorable men. Remember, your life in the community is the sounding board of your sermon. It may be ever so polished and finished and fine, may be ever so perfect, but your life is the sounding board of your sermon. And that is why some men that you listen to, who seem to violate every rule of good public speaking, are very effective preachers. Because when he's standing up there speaking, those words come to the listener through the life of the minister. And that's why oftentimes people prefer to hear their own minister than no matter who or how great the pastor may be. They know their pastor. They don't know that man that comes there to visit. This is the greatness of, in many ways, of being a preacher. Your life is the sounding board of your sermon. If he is an honorable man, this is the terrible test for all of us. And this, I think, is what causes many men want to quit the ministry. Because they know they aren't as good as that word honorable implies many times. I can remember one time my son, one of my sons who's not living, but he was looking at me with such worshipful eyes. I said to my wife, I'm not one half as good as he thinks I am. And I said, it hurts to have him look at me that way. And I think every minister has the same feeling. And this is the agony of the ministry, I think. It's the agony that, no, you are not that honorable man, at least on that level. You can be lazy, you can be dishonest, you can be careless, you can have faults and flaws, and it's a tough one. But there are many ways in which we, all of us, ought to measure up. One is in the handling of money, for example. Be honorable in the handling of money. I know of a man in a certain town, a butcher, who doesn't go to church, and he's bitter. The minister in that community would charge and charge and never pay his bill. Couple of times the butcher good-naturedly check it off, say, Pastor, okay. But then he began to abuse this kindness of the butcher. And one day when the minister came in to order some meat, it was $3-4 of meat, and he waited, and the minister said, charge it. And the butcher said to the man, you pay your bill, or, he said, you keep this meat, we'll call off, but never come into my place of business again. The minister picked up the meat, went out, and didn't go in, but neither did the man go in his church. I've known a number of ministers to be very careless in this area, in the money. I know of a minister in the American Lutheran Church right now who is having emotional troubles, and I know he hasn't paid his bills 15 and 20 years ago. A particular merchant I know that told me, he said, I've sent him notices again and again to pay his bills. But he wrote back, I saw the letter which this minister wrote back saying, I'm in the work of God, and it is for you to help us poor ambassadors of Christ. And you are, he implied that the man was very selfish, that he didn't cancel out the bill. I think that when I was in Minneapolis, a student at the seminary, went to one of the fine clothing houses there, and walks in with a big swagger, and going to charge a suit, and they wanted to get some evidence that he could pay the bill, and he became very angry. I'm a minister. I'm studying for the ministry. I'm a student at Luther Seminary. Well, you can imagine all those men around in that very fine business place, what their reaction was, how they looked with contempt upon this man, and then it overflows into the ministry. Let us be honorable men. Let us be honorable in our handling of money, paying the bills, and of handling the money in the church. We can easily be careless here. Let other people handle the money as much as possible. You and I are not greedy men. If we were, we wouldn't be in the ministry. But that very thing can cause us to be a little bit careless in this area, because it's very important to a lot of people, as part money, so that they will misjudge you very much if you're a bit careless in the handling of money. Have people sign where you can. I made a few mistakes in my own life where I take some money from people, and then afterwards they'd claim it was a certain amount, and counting it was not that amount. You're trapped then. If you'd done it in the beginning, had them count it and sign a statement, it's so much money. You've saved and protected yourself. Also, all of you have been suckers too in the area of people borrowing money from you, and members of your parish, and sympathetic appeal. I've had my leg pulled a number of times, not any great sums, but you go through that experience. That's part of it. Then I suggest also you be a bit careful in your dress. There are extremes in everything, you know. I think one of our fellows that finished the seminary and went out to Montana to be a preacher, and in this rural area, the call committee came up to meet him in their good Western clothes, and here he gets off the spats, glasses with a ribbon down, and a colored vest, and they walked right by him. They were looking for the preacher.
Then I think of another minister who came to a western town. He hadn't been there long before he had two huge police dogs about that high, wore a big western hat, all the affectations which were not natural for him. People expect you to be natural and in your dress and attire. Be neat, clean, tidy. A lady joined my church when I lived in Eau Claire, because when the pastor served communion, he didn't have clean fingernails. She'd see that hand come towards her with dirty fingernails. She said she just couldn't take it and had to go. Back in those days, it was not uncommon for ministers to chew tobacco. Another minister in my community there chewed tobacco, and he used to come a little dribble down the corner of his mouth. And he was also a very affectionate pastor. One of the young women in his church joined my parish, and she told me that when she was sick in the hospital, he'd leaned over and kissed her. So I didn't mind that so much, but that tobacco dripping down here. Well, I said, now don't get confused. Don't think I carry on the same custom of kissing my patients, I said, if you join for that reason. I can assure you I don't chew tobacco. But tidy in appearance, and then also here comes another area, our attitude towards the opposite sex. It used to be a very cold relationship in the days gone by. We were so afraid even to look at a woman, afraid to be accused of adultery. In the days gone by, there was a rigidity to the minister. When I began my ministry, I wore a cutaway, wing collar, black tie. And I was a big poopah when I walked down the street. But I never wore out the suit. I never wore it out. My wife finally made it over to clothes for the kids. But this was typical of all clergymen. We walked down the streets, all of us, as little popes. This, I think much of it came from our European influence. This is characteristic of all of the clergy, in a large measure, if they were Lutherans. And the Missouri Lutherans were somewhat the worst. I think of one of them who used to eat separate from his family. He had a little room where his wife brought in the meals to serve them, because ordinary people couldn't eat with the minister. This was an extreme case, but it was typical of the attitude towards the clergy.
Now, one wife who never called her husband by his first name. It was always Mr. or Reverend.
Isn't that that reminds me of music. When I was a pastor in Minneapolis, I frequently had ministers' wives come to me for counseling, because they could come with an anonymity that I wouldn't know who they were. I told them, you didn't tell me your name, who you are. Just tell me what you would like to have me help you with. One came, rather dowdy dressed wife of a Missouri Lutheran preacher there in Minneapolis. And she said, my husband told me bluntly, all I was for was to bear children and take care of the house, and to ask no questions, and he would provide what was necessary in clothes and so on. Treated her like one of the servants. Well, I said, now you have a couple of choices. One, you can continue the way you are. Just accept it and work out your life in this area the best way you know. The other is to write a note on the desk, on his desk, and say, goodbye, I'm leaving you. I'm going to live my own life separate from you. That's one choice. Third one is, if you're really bold enough, is to, and I'll see that it's paid for, the expense of it, will not cost you anything. I want you to go to a beauty parlor. And I want yourself to be fixed up and look a little bit more like a woman. Mm-hmm. And second is, I want you to dress differently. I'm going to send you to another woman, Dayton's, and I'll have her dress you. And this will all be paid for by somebody else, so you don't need to worry. I'm not paying for it personally. The church provided me the fund to do some of these things. And I said, then come home. And you could tell your husband, he can ask all the questions, and if he gets really mad, send him down here and I'll talk to him. So I said, but you go home and think this over. And then come back in a week or so. But I said, it'll take a lot of gumption and backbone on your part to tell your husband it's going to be a different world. And I said, I believe he'll like it in the end, too. I said, he'd much prefer to have you as a wife than a servant. But she came back a week later and says, I just don't have the courage. Well, I said, then you'll just have to go back to the routine that you've been in before. I wish there'd been a happy ending to it, but that's the end of it. I never saw the woman again. I did see the minister a number of times, and I could readily understand why it was. What I'm trying to say to you, that was the ministry in 1923, 24, 25, on down. Today we have a much easier relationship with the opposite sex, and what I'm most happy about. When I began my ministry, when a woman was to have a baby, we wouldn't see her for the 4 or 5 months when she was out of shape. She wouldn't come around, and she was in hiding, as it were. And you wouldn't mention the idea she's pregnant. That'd be too embarrassing. But I think when I left Central Lutheran Church, one of the members said to me, one of the women said one Sunday morning, she said, you'll not see me next Sunday. I said, why not? She said, I'm having a baby this week. It was as casual as that. And I said, good luck to you. What hospital are you going to? And how much more normal, more natural, and more intelligent this is to recognize that women do get pregnant and that they do have babies. And I think it makes it easier for people to talk to us. And not only that, but you see, we add the joy and the personality in the life of the female to our lives too. I think we, in the past, used to shut out many of the contributions the opposite sex could give to our lives because of that extreme barrier that is European and Oriental, and it's much worse in the Oriental area. I've been in the Orient in many homes where I never saw a woman, just men servants, men all around. Where the women were, I don't know, maybe out in the kitchen. As a matter of fact, I did, by accident, open the door and go into the kitchen of a certain place, and boy, the women scurried like flies. That was the attitude then, and in the early of our history of our church, and probably lingers in some areas, I don't know. But today, the average man can speak very easily with women. Therein also lies its danger. You can be susceptible to the approach of the opposite sex, and as long before, they will imagine many things about you too. A lady came to me when I was a pastor in Milwaukee and said she wanted to join my church. I said, you're a member of Sonsa Lutheran Church? Yes. I said, why do you want to leave there? She said, the minister's fallen in love with me. I said, are you sure? Yes, as I know it. And she said, I said, has he embraced you, kissed you? No. Has he spoken words of love to you or written you notes? No. Has he ever made any attempt to have any overt action towards you? And she said, no. Well, I said, how do you know? She said, I can tell it the way he looks at me when he's preaching. Now, there's no more than that. And called her husband over and later and talked to him. But you can see what a predicament the man might have gotten in. And the words peddled around in that church about this woman. She enlarged on quite a few things that were not true, plain lies. But these things can happen. So we have to be careful in this particular area. When I was young and handsome like you fellows, a lady, a young woman stopped me after church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Said, Pastor, I'd like to have you come home and see me and arrange for a baptism of my child. I said, I'd be very glad to. So I came to this home. It was upstairs. I can still see the place upstairs in the store. I went up those stairs and came in, and she said, come in here and we'll talk in this room, she said. And as we went down that hall, it was into a bedroom. And just as I went by the bathroom. The door was slightly open, and now through the crack in the door, I could see a man hunched back to the door.
Oh, boy.
And I turned around, ran down the stairs, and said, if you want to see me about a baptism. I was more scared than intelligent. I ran down those stairs and went back to the church. But I have no doubt, as what I learned later of this woman, that she intended to blackmail me. That this man was there, she'd probably tear her clothes and then scream. He'd come out and threaten me and say, here you are. You pay this, or you may be one of the members of the church. Then I remember another time a woman came to the door in her nightgown. When I called her home, she came to the door, and she was a mental case. So I said, you get dressed and come to my office, and I'll be very glad to talk to you. She had many emotional problems, but you can see these are things in this period of greater familiarity and easier talking with the opposite sex, how dangerous it is and how it can destroy that he is an honorable man. I think of an amusing one when I was in Minneapolis. I got lots of mail when I was up there. I did a great deal of counseling, and I got a letter once from a woman, a very endearing letter. My darling Elmer, began. And I thought one of my minister's friends having some fun with me, so I called my secretary and I said, read this, what some of my preacher friends write to me. She read it and she says, that's no preacher friend. She said, that's a woman that wrote that. Oh, I said, can't be. And then another letter came another week, and we recognized, well, could say much about it, but she began to come over to the church and wanted to see me. I visited with a number of times and saw that there was purely some physical attachment towards me. And one day, I'd alerted the whole staff so they'd keep her away from my office, and also the ushers. She tried to get into the sacristy on Sunday morning before service. So one morning, the janitor came to me, and he said, I think that woman has slept all night in the old central, in the old church. She said, she's in there. So I called the police and swore a warrant against her for disturbing the peace of the community. And lo and behold, I found out she was the wife of a prominent doctor in a neighboring community. I told my wife, it's only the women that are nuts that go after me.
How did she like that?
That has some implications. But ordinary common sense protects us most of the time. And usually when I was in Minneapolis, I was often called out at night to see somebody. I would take somebody along with me. And in the day, I would take my secretary with me if I was called to a place, which I was a little bit leery about. And in that way, I have some degree of protection for anything that happened. And as I visited with ministers, over the years, I found many of them having somewhat similar experiences. But there are a lot of people that love scandal about the preacher. You know? Boy, there's nothing that pleases them more than if they can find some questionable, salacious story that they can repeat or peddle about a minister. So let's avoid it if we can, but you never can avoid it completely. I'm now that age where I don't really care what anybody says about me. You arrive at the point where you're calloused about what anybody thinks. I think of the amusement. A couple came to me to arrange for adoption of a child in Minneapolis. And I said, have you been to a doctor? Yes. And he said, nothing wrong with us, but he said, nothing wrong, but we just don't have children. Well, I said, I would like to try an experiment with you two, if you will cooperate. I said, I'd like to see you change the pattern of your life entirely. I said to her, I would like to have you quit working. Change your dress and attire, change your hairdo and clothes, become more feminine. I said, you're too businesslike, and you're not feminine enough. Second is, I told her, the man, I think you ought to have a new suit. She told me on the side he'd have the same suit for 2-3 years. And I said, I want you to go out once a week to dinner. And I rearranged everything. I suggested her home, house, everything. You see, the chemistry of a woman's body is easily affected by her emotions, and her emotions are easily affected by the setting. So they did, they cooperated very, very fine. And within 2 months, they came in happily and said she was pregnant. They had the baby, I baptized the baby. Her parents lived down in southern Minnesota. And one day I received a letter from the grandma. And she wrote a letter with a generous check to Central Lutheran Church. And she said, "Thank you very much," she said, "for I feel you're responsible for the baby." And I kept that letter for a long time. I think the story of the fellow that went to the hospital, his wife was going to have a baby. And he sat in the waiting room waiting. And finally the nurse came out with the baby. She had her mask on, come from the living room. He was overjoyous. Another nurse came out with another baby. Of course, he was quite happy, twins. But then a third nurse came out with another baby. The poor guy was getting pretty excited. And he got up and wanted to go in the delivery room. And the nurse said to him, "Get out of here. You can't come in here. You're not sterile." He said, "You telling me?" Well, I think another way in which we can be honorable is in our relationship to one another as ministers. It's very easy for us to be very unctuous in our criticism of fellow pastors, that we speak from a high pedestal, from a lofty position in criticism. Not that we ministers should be so tender that we can't take criticism. And I'm exceedingly grateful for the friends I've had in the ministry who were kind enough to be very critical towards me at important times. I think the average minister doesn't have the kind of friends that he should have. I can remember in Eau Claire, a minister came and attended my services, and he wrote me a nice letter afterwards. And this is one of the best ways to do it. And in this letter, he complimented me on a number of things, and then he listed about 5 or 6 things he thought should be different in my manner of speech, what I said, and they were pretty sharp, but they were all good. Now, if he'd said them to me in person, I might have gotten mad and on the defensive. But there they were, right smack in front of me, and I had to look at them. And they did me a great deal of good. Then I think of a layman who is an excellent critic of mine, Joe Norby. He was superintendent of Fairview Hospital at one time. Then he was a member of my church in Milwaukee. But he could be critical about little things, which were important. He was very sharp. And he would take me to task on some things. But he did it out of love, Christian love. It was not... He wanted that minister of his to be good and be honorable. So his criticism was very good. And I'm very grateful to the people who were critical of me in the years of my ministry. Know that some people, of course, they just do it because they want to knock you down. Clem Grunskow, president of St. Olaf, says the characteristic about the Norwegians, they can't stand anybody get above the average level. Whether that's Norwegians' characteristic or not. But he said, let the Norwegian get up, he said, a little bit above the rest of them, everybody wants to knock him down. We worship mediocrity, he said. I said that to a friend of mine as district president. I said, that's why you elected. But this man is a superior one, and he could very easily take it that he's good nature. But I think there is a tendency among all clergy and all of us, we want to knock somebody down. I remember when I was in Minneapolis, somebody was criticizing Pastor Youngdahl severely. I said, it's funny, isn't it? If he were a Catholic priest and getting that mass of people coming to church, all of us would be saying, boy, I wish we had a Lutheran preacher like that, that could do that and get crowds like that. Well, we got one. But instead of being and praising him and thanking him for it, we want to stalk him on the head and knock him down. My first year at Central Lutheran Church, I received savage letters from preachers, and including seminary professors. I used to see a little row of seminary students up there taking notes on my sermon. Another one even made tape recorders and sent to the district president and said, this guy's a heretic and he ought to be thrown out of the church. Brotherly love. This made me probably a little too calloused and cynical of preachers. But on the other hand, I found that without their support, I could get no place. And the same with you men. We need each other. We need each other. And we should help each other. We should encourage each other. We should praise each other. And if something is going on significant in somebody else's church, go over there if you can. When I was installed in Westchester Lutheran, only one minister came. And he just happened to be there because he was a personal friend. That was all. I went to the installation of a minister in our, about 5-6 miles from us in our church. I was the only minister that came over there. What's the matter with this man? Are we so jealous and small and that we can't encourage and praise another man and give him credit? Jealousy is among preachers just as well as anybody else. You remember in the Screwtape Letters where the little devil had gone up to tempt one of the ministers and he hadn't been successful. He hadn't gotten any place. Tried every possible temptation. He came back to the big devil and he said, I tell you, all you need to do is go up and tell him that Reverend so-and-so has been promoted to bishop and that'll get him. It's a subtle way of saying it's difficult for us to see another man bride, but it isn't only us. I was visiting one of the patients in my one of my parishes, and the patient had changed doctors, and in came the new doctor while I was there. He looked at the medicine that the other doctor prescribed. He looked at the patient. Did the other doctor prescribe this? And they just prescribed new medicine, the jealousy. Rather than saying, this in many instances is excellent medicine, and it may be what you need, but I'd like to try something else. That's faithless. I think also of Tilden and Johnson, the two great tennis players. In 1923, they were playing a match in the United States for the national championship. Each one had won the national championship once, and now the third time was for the person to keep the cup. It was a tremendous match. Tilden, that 6'2", 3" tennis player, Johnson, much shorter. The match lasted a long time, but finally Tilden won. And when he'd finished, Johnson leaped over the net, ran over to Tilden, and he said this, I played the best game I knew how, but you played a better one. That's greatness. And this is the quality that should be in the ministry. I went to the seminary like the rest of you boys and heard all the lectures on what is the church and all the technical terms and all the philosophy about it and all the quotations, all the business. And then you get out and you find that the men in the ministry have a rather low concept of the church, that it's not a brotherhood of us preaching the gospel. We are competing with each other too much. We're in the boat together. It isn't like the two men in the lifeboat in the boat began to sink, and one says, what do we care? It doesn't belong to us. Well, it does belong to us. We're all in the same boat. And if it goes down, as I often said in Minneapolis, if you fellas in the suburb fail, you affect my parish. If I fail, I affect yours. If you succeed, I succeed. Your success is my success. I belong to your church, you belong to mine. And this to me is the doctrine of the church. Jesus points to us and says, you belong to me. And we can point to him and say, we belong to you.
And it should be said, communicated. If you fellows don't know, Minneapolis Central is the big one in the ALC. And The men respect the fact that many of the people that are in their parish are there because their children need a neighborhood church. And yet, it's like Al Brunson said many one time, he says, they still love Central, and I respect that love. He says, Westwood can never be Central, there's only one. So it's interesting how it goes both ways.
Yes, thank you. It certainly was true. I could say much more on that score if you get me off into this area of Central Lutheran Church, because we had many, many unusual experiences there. I felt our province wasn't to become a big church, but to be a minister, in a sense, to all the churches. That couples that moved in, lived in those apartments, were there for a year or two, got their feet on the ground, and then moved to a new locality outside. We encouraged them to join other churches. I've said to you as respect for our fellow ministers. Another thing in this score is, remember, we preachers are not all alike. We have gifts in different areas. And instead of being critical, let us encourage it. And take Carol right here. It's a different type of a ministry than the rest of us. Instead of saying, what the thunder is he doing up there in Holden Village? This is something we should be behind and support. That's a type of ministry. Reuben Gernitsky is another type of ministry. I was with a group of ministers who said, Reuben should be out of the Lutheran Church. He should be defrocked. He's not carrying on the parish, isn't there? I said, he's experimenting in an area in which he probably can do it better than any of the rest of us. He's got a personality and talent and ability. And I said, it may be a complete flop, but even in the flop, we'll have learned something. Or I think of Conrad Broughton, who I was the chairman of the World Brothers Exchange, in which he was our director. He paid very little attention to the board and very little attention to me as a chairman. But that's perfectly all right. He's one of these individualists, and he accomplishes his purpose. And I felt it was my duty as chairman to keep the board out of his way. and then we did to some degree success. But the World Brother Exchange grew into such an organization that now the CUSA took it over, as you know. And they have a budget of $80,000 a year for the CUSA and our headquarters in New York. We have to have these men who are experimenting, feeling, falling on their face, trying things, falling on their face. But these are things that we need to support. The Catholic Church has been much smarter than we have on this score. When I lived in Milwaukee, I used to bump into Catholic priests in different areas. One man was an expert in social welfare. That's all he did. Another one was an expert in youth problems. Another one an expert in, I remember him, Monsignor Haas, expert in the field of labor and capital, and helped write some of the labor legislation in the United States. That's all he had to do. Church says, now you just go ahead, study, work, we'll leave you alone, see that you're taken care of. And here I, as a minister, attempted to be an authority in all these areas. Couldn't begin to compete with those fellows. So whenever you find a man going off in a direction like this, get behind him, support him, encourage him. It's a pretty lonely business for those fellows. It's a pretty lonely business. They many times don't know whether the thing's going to succeed or fail. They don't know if they're going to fall on their face or not. And then if they do fall on their face, they can look like saps. You and I are in somewhat a settled parish location. What I'm appealing to you is to encourage one another, regardless of our capacities or abilities.
You know, I think this runs another direction too, and that is recognizing differences, and that is, I think most parish pastors run with this problem of looking at the other guys around them and seeing all of their strong points and comparing those against himself. And one guy has a hot stewardship program, another guy has a good evangelism, another guy has parish education, and you kind of manufacture in your mind a super pastor that you try to be, and you can go out of your mind doing
that's
this
right.
Until you recognize that the Lord didn't call them to this parish, that he called you.
Yeah.
And I think recognizing the difference has to be recognizing your own difference, too.
That's why I tell my parish every time I had a call, you know, and a lot of them hopefully hoping, you know. I say to them, well, I just have to figure it's like my wife. I can think of 100 men that would make a better husband than my
marriage. It reminds me of Kepler, the scientist, who drew up a list of qualifications of the perfect wife. And then he went around looking for a woman who fit those qualifications. He found one, married her, and it became a terrible marriage. The worst possible. And of course, the mistake was he never knew the qualifications of a perfect husband. It is true, ministers being human, we like to succeed, good sense of the word. And a parishioner comes and says, well, they got loose lead over there, you ought to see just jam packed. Look at the driblet you got in the church. And of course, it does make you feel a bit uncomfortable.
Dr. Sparre, PLU, I'll never forget one of the things he told us in the parish workers' course back in the late 40s. He said, just remember in your life, always be natural, be yourself. And he impressed that so much in one of the courses I had that it really made an impression on me. Be yourself. Don't try to be somebody else. Just be yourself.
Yeah.
And this is real important.
Yes, it is.
To be able to live with yourself and be able to do your best job.
I presume that too many times we've tried to be somebody else, worn a mask. It's much easier for you men today by far than it was when I began ministry. I couldn't go to any meeting without feeling I had to wear my mask. Even among ministers, we had to be very pious and walk around as though we were looking for a chance to pronounce the benediction.
I think the most profound remark in our life.
Yeah, no, tea at the time. I remember the saying of some course, if I have to go to hell for it, I'm going to be myself. Well, what kind of church would God work for if I have to say that? But Red River Valley,
Don't you feel the breakdown though also in even in our pastoral conferences and stuff today where we just really aren't ourselves at so much of the time?
It is so
tragic that we can't have dialogue and really.
I think one of the reasons with me it was I was always a heretic and was taken to task a number of times by the president of the church. And there were a number of efforts to keep me out of the church. And I always felt when I came into a group of ministers, they were looking for a chance to take me apart. And not being a theologian, it was very easy for them to do it. So I couldn't speak what was on my mind. I was afraid to say it. I'd just talk baseball or football or whatever it was, but never religion. Stay away from that when you're among ministers.
Richard, even on preaching, you know, I think it's got to do with the fact that preaching, the fellows are wearing a mask still. They can't share, they can't open up.
Yeah.
Because they're not doing it with each other. Now, those old-time preachers are cornballs, a lot of them, but they did have some fun together.
Yeah.
That rope of game down there, you know, I never had to open up the envelope. The steam had already taken the glue off of it. But they did have a crazy glue coat on, and they were having a good time, you know. And really, I was in Cora. So interest you guys, because I was there when all the pastors were in from the surrounding area. You know, they had that big heresy hunt down there. I had to be there right then, preaching them. And I opened up with remarks. You've got to see these guys, you know, coming up there and they get at this religion faculty. You know, some of these boys I've had myself times past and they're getting their chance to get free on the religion department. And so I just asked these pastors, one kind old guy was retired after I said this really had a good laugh. I'll tell you just what he said to me. I said, you know, in the old days when preachers got together, they fought. They played rook, they stayed all night, told stories. I said, when's the last time you guys have had any fun? This is usually my first counseling question anyway. And they looked kind of funny at each other, and then the old guy started to laugh. He said, I told my wife the same thing again. He says, Kinderly, it's just me. He says, we haven't had any fun since World War II. In a workshop every time we've been together. He says, that's why we got to pick on somebody.
It is, yeah.
I mean, one thing, you were always bouncing, and they don't like it when you bounce.
Well, if you only repent.
No bleeding.
Well, I think there's a much more wholesome attitude, which comes from the recognition on our part how ignorant we are. That is, we know how difficult it is with youth. We know how difficult it is in the world today with a lot of people. I think we appreciate our own ignorance. And as I approach you, I don't approach you that you're infallible or that I am fallible, but that I got a lot to learn from you. I just read an item, or rather one of the parishioners of a congregation out east told me that their minister, this was about a year ago, was meeting with his confirmation class one at a time, not the whole class. He never had the whole class together, but just one at a time. And I thought, that's an interesting idea. So as I was telling some of the men here last night, I started last year meeting three at a time and not the whole class. It takes much more time, but a lot easier and a lot pleasanter to teach. No discipline problem. And the children learning to know me and I to know them personally. We can discuss their school, their plans, their ambitions, their home, and their problems. Where in class of 25, 30 kids in front of you, or 40, that discipline problem's everlastingly present. You either become a policeman or an old fogey or something to these kids. Now, that one little pinch I got from a parishioner telling me about his own church back home. We can learn from each other if we'll swallow our pride in this particular area. I think another reason is, we as ministers have also been influenced by the philosophy of the world called success. We must be successful. And what does the average parishioner ask you, visitor, when he comes to, how big is your church? That's the first question I ask. How big is your congregation?
What's the budget?
And it isn't only parishioners, but we can excuse them. But ministers, it's quite another thing. You and I ought to know that the success of a church does not lie in the size of its building, nor the number in the congregation, nor even the attendance on Sunday morning, but it is in the spiritual depth of the people and in their involvement in life on the Christian level. This we ought to know, and these are difficult things to measure. But we are all caught in this confounded thing of success. I hear it constantly. I remember with amusement when I was on the chairman of the alumni board of St. Olaf, they sent me around to alumni groups speaking around the country. And when I was then pastor at Central. And as you know, the church is large and does seat 3,000. When I got to North Dakota, the church seated 4,000. When I got to the state of Washington speaking there, it seated 4,000, but there were 3-4 services on a Sunday. And then when I got down to California, a man introduced me, said I was pastor of Central Lutheran. Where the church seated 5,000, they had 3 services, and had to turn away people, and he spoke to so-and-so. Mm-hmm. I said there was a slight error. It was not the main sanctuary that seated 5,000, it was the sacristy. And I said, when we took up a collection, we had the Brinks truck go down the center. Well, you get the feeling how ridiculous is this idea. But the same thing is true of all of us, I think, in the community in which we live. And we get so terribly afraid of making mistakes and making in the pulpit or any other place if we have dumb things. Well, I remember an assistant I had, he made a mistake in a sermon. He just was tortured for weeks afterwards. Oh, I said, don't worry. It'll come another Sunday, you can make some more mistakes. And all of you here, I'm sure, made plenty. I have my share of them that I've made. And you can laugh and sweat about them, but still they bothered you at the time. I can remember in Milwaukee marrying a prominent woman, and I called her by the wrong name. Her name was Mary, and I called Elizabeth also. Afterwards, one of the deacons rushed up to me, Pastor, did you know you called her Elizabeth? Oh, I said, what difference does it make? The Lord knew I was bearing anyhow, so that's all that's important. You have to learn a certain amount of callousness and shrug it off. And if you do, they do too. But if you get all wrought up about it, they'll get all wrought up too. You have to learn to brush it off. Remember, gentlemen, we are public figures. We are public figures. And if a man doesn't want to be a public figure, he'd better not go in the ministry. Therefore, a public figure is never as good as he is sainted, nor as bad as he is painted. It's well to remember that. Both his vices and virtues are highly exaggerated. You may like to believe only the virtues. I have received credit in my ministry for many good things which I never did. And I've been cursed for some things I never did. It balances out. So don't get too excited. I recall in Milwaukee, I was walking through the hospital, and a photographer grabbed me. Come on, he said, I got to get a picture for the Milwaukee Journal. He said, come in here. He said, there's a child in here. I want you to visit and talk with this child, take the picture. I didn't even know the child. We rushed in and took a picture, and I went on with others. And next one, nice big picture. Pastor brings joy to the children in the hospital. Man, I didn't even know the child they called on. And I had any number of people come in and say, wasn't that wonderful for you, Pastor? Wasn't that great of you, Pastor, to call on the kids? I felt like I could crawl under the bed. I was getting credit for something I'd never done. But that's part of the ministry. The next time you'll be cursed for something that you never did. It's part of the whole business, so don't be too excited either way. There's more to be said on here, but can anybody else think of anything in the word honorable?
There's an illustration, I forget the book, I just read it, forget the author, but it was concerned a rabbi and a cantor and a humble synagogue cleaner. And they were preparing the synagogue for Day of Atonement festivities. And the rabbi stood there and beat his breast and said, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the cantor followed suit and he beat his breast and said, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the humble little synagogue cleaner, watching the rabbi and the cantor, thought he'd better follow suit. And he beat his breast and said, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the rabbi very surprisedly looked over at the cantor and said, my, look who thinks he's nothing.
That'll be my sermon next Sunday. That's like the item I read of the three bakers on the same street. One baker put a sign in front of his store, we bake the best bread in the United States. And the next one down says, we bake the best bread in the whole world. And the third one says, we bake the best bread on this street. And bring it down to a smaller area. And it's
you know, I wonder if another area where that is that we all have a tendency, I think, of talking even in vague terms about our previous parish or people who have come in and this type of thing. And it really struck me the other day, I was copying some tapes that had been loaned to us. And it happened that, there are two specific either, but it happened that a pastor from our area was on the panel. And he was making, this panel happened to be back in the Midwest, but he made some rather sharp, specific comments about people who I knew were going to be listening to this tape. Mm. By not mentioning by name, but you know, very obvious. Mm. And I couldn't help but think to myself how this must hurt his image, his relationship with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. In leaving a parish or coming to a new one, we always have to be very careful that we do not do damage either way. I've had the most happy relationships, for example, with Milwaukee when I was in Chicago. Hoover Grimsby is the pastor at Ascension Lutheran Church where I serve. And he makes me feel I'm always welcome. And he's called me up on the telephone and said, can you come in for this funeral? Sell him if ever can. And he'll write and say, Mr. So-and-so has passed away. She thought the world of you and you had much to do with her. Suppose you write her a note and so-and-so or the family. Time and again he's done that. And he's brought little items in his paper. He's made me feel warm. And in turn, I have been able to make a contribution to his ministry. He's used me in a good sense. And those people who were loyal to me are now intensely loyal to him. I think this is something we can learn too. We are men of strong egos. That's one of the reasons we're ministers. I hate to admit this in front of you, John, but men have much stronger egos than women. And this is where so many wives fail in handling their husbands. Many a time a man will go to a corner tavern where he's drinking and some women is praising him, telling him he's the greatest guy that ever lived, and he hasn't heard that for a long time. His wife hasn't let him believe he's anybody. So as a consequence, he goes, and then the paper thinks in terms of sex, and it has nothing to do with it particularly. It's just that he's looking for somebody to make build up his ego. We ministers get our egos built up probably more than any other class. Is that the coffee bell?
This is a good thing that Audrey argues too. This is the very thing. Sex is secondary, his territory is first, and that's why the ego is his territory.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
No, that's right. That's what we mean.
And many a man is crushed and beaten because his wife doesn't build him up. I'm dealing with a couple right now. I've told the wife to quit mothering your husband. He's sick and tired of a mother. He wants a wife, a companion. But too many wives want to mother their husbands. And too many husbands like it to begin with, but ultimately they don't. Is that the coffee break?
Yeah, it is.
All right, we can...
I was just telling you, here. I heard the marriage counselor not long ago saying that the phrase helpmeet in the Old Testament, I will make a helpmeet for him, actually means one who responds to the call of another in need.
Well, that's a good way to put it.
I think from my running around the church that I have stayed now for 14 years, you know, one of my friends kid me about what am I really doing? I said, I'm working with the pastor's wife, making him feel important. Who are you preaching here, you know?
Good.
But really, the lure of a woman and that she knows she's got her blow still and come in and flirt with her a little bit, and suddenly her husband realizes maybe he's been taking her for granted a little. But that's why I say, you've got to take it. I'm going to leave now and come back. But this is, like I said, it's one thing. Take a weekend in between Sundays, at least every season. Just take a weekend. Yeah. Nobody's going to criticize you for it. They won't even know you're gone, much to your sorrow maybe, but they won't. And just get out of it and then come back. And it's a crazy thing. They criticize you when you're gone in the summer. We know. They figure out every day you're gone. The other day you come back, and now you left somebody. They have spotty in the apartment. They see when you left the garage. But they don't. These others, they couldn't care less. And there's where you come, I think, it will be your punishment again. And not least with your wife, take your own. That's all I'd say when it's coming up. And if you want to come up here, fine. But there are a lot of other nice places around the loop.
Shorty, you mentioned Hoover Grimsby, and I had an opportunity to intern Hoover. And this is one thing that is finally dawning on me. I realize what it did for me, but I'm a little defensive over against these young men coming out of the seminary. I have a second one, sharp guy from the seminary, and last year's was that way too. And I finally got around the point, well, how in the dickens did Hoover do it, you know? And the way Hoover does it is exactly the way he treats one like yourself, as a former pastor. He does this with everybody. He is constantly building up and puts you up there so far that you know good and well you don't even belong, but he believes that this is where you can go. Mm-hmm. And this constant reinforcing of you as a person, you see, that you can do it, I'm behind you. And this sort of thing, and he goes way up on top as a result. Mm-hmm. The more he builds you up, the more the perish.
That's
put him right up, you know, he's the little prince.
Yeah.
Really is. So I've done this with interns when I get real irritated. When I quit being irritated and I just start praising them. And when the parishioners are around, they say something, I just reinforce it. Yeah, that guy is good that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I come out all right. I couldn't stand it otherwise. I really couldn't. My wife's getting a little irritated. What are you praising so much? I said, well, he needs it. And then they'll put me up, too. And they do.
I think he has since passed away. And if you know, he's a Minneapolis man, a very fine Christian gentleman. He was also chairman of the board of Garrett Biblical Institute or seminary in Chicago. When the president was installed there, Dwight Loader, he was asked to give the installation sermon at the time. Bullis from Minneapolis came down there to give it. He spoke on what the layman looks for in a minister.
Mm-hmm.
The whole sermon or speech is very good.
which I will not read, but you may, if you wish, see it. But I mention quickly the points he brings out. One is, he said, I want to feel that at all times my minister is constantly being illuminated by God, that he maintains a ceaseless relationship with his Creator, that he is never confused about who is his actual boss. Quite a statement, isn't it? We would use different terms. We would say that the minister must have his own private devotional life. And he goes on and he says, let me explain it in business terms. And he goes on to speak of his relationship with those under him, that I work through them. And I always remember Buddha saying to a group of men, businessmen, remember, the product isn't nearly as important as the men who work for us. And come in, girls. Come in, you're welcome. Don't be overawed by preachers, nobody else is.
Yeah, just preachers.
Of course, if we had our vestments on, it'd be different. I think that's a good question, why? When I first became pastor at Central, I was at the YMCA about a month or two later taking a shower bath. And I turned to the man standing next to me in the shower bath, and being a good evangelist, I said to him, what church do you belong to? What church you go to? Well, he said, I go to a church down here a few blocks. He said, Central Lutheran. Well, I said, I happen to be the minister there. And he looked at me and he says, you? So I told the congregation about it the next Sunday. I said, then and there I resolved that whenever I took a shower bath in the YMCA, I'd always wear my best boots.
Was that the first heresy trial?
Well, let's see, here he said, the second thing I look for in the minister is for sincerity and enthusiasm. These are basic requirements. Faith to move mountains. His third is, scriptures tell us that with God all things are possible. Therefore, I look for a positive mental attitude in my minister to reinforce my qualities, to give me a certain positive note in my living. And this is fourth, and I would put this first, as I think most of you men would. I want my minister to like people, we would say, love people. Because there's a difference. You can't like a lot of people whom you love. I can't see how these nurses working in a leper colony can like some of the things they see, but they love the people. I want my minister to like people more precisely. In the scripture sense, he must love people, all kinds of people, all levels, all races, all colors, and all creeds. This love must enable him to translate his ministry into service of the Lord. And the next one, I like my minister to have a rich sense of humor. It proves that he has a human approach to problems of men and takes all God's purposes seriously. I think the ministers today have a much better sense of humor. I think they can laugh at themselves, even when they fall on their face. They're not nearly as solemn as they used to be. We confuse solemnity with seriousness, and not the same thing. He tells of to illustrate this, he has I'm sure you've heard this story in different ways. He said there was a certain minister that liked his sip of cherry brandy now and then. And the parishioner offered a bottle to the minister if the minister would have promised to announce the gift in the next issue of the church bulletin. The minister agreed. So the next Sunday morning, the church bulletin carried this. The pastor thanks Mr. Hansen for his gift of fruit and for the spirit in which it was given. And then there are other qualities too. He said, I'd like my minister to be a good speaker. And as I mentioned the first time,
that in our business we should be good public speakers. Simple things like enunciation, variation of tone, all the other qualities should be heard, should muffle our speech. And then he goes on to speak, here he said, the reference library is a great source for sermons, but he said, the most valuable source is to be found in the lives of people. I think the minister should not stick too closely to his study of theology, but should become more informed about people. And he goes on to say that he should have a heartwarming sense of humor, and also, it's rather a summary of the whole thing. Anyone, any comment? This is a businessman. It's good to get other people slant of what they think the minister should be, what he should be like. You know, sometimes we ministers forget our own families. As somebody mentioned earlier, there should be a, looking for a certain article here, I can find it. When I was a pastor in Minneapolis, I had to be downtown early in the morning and frequently didn't get home till late evening. Sometimes 2-3 days would go by, I wouldn't see my son going to school. Because of noon meetings and evening meetings, I didn't get to see him. One day he got in a little trouble in Roosevelt High School, and the teacher called him in and asked him, what's the trouble? And he said, I wish I could see my father more often. And the teacher called me in and told me this. It shook me up a bit. And how many ministers there are that neglect their family? I don't think the ministry demands of us that we neglect our family, our children. Doesn't mean you have to be with them, of course, all the time. But I know of many instances where pastors have neglected their children. They've displayed a tremendous outgoing personality in the congregation and in the community, but not with their family. This isn't only true of the ministry, it is true of other occupations as well. Speaking to a women's club in Milwaukee, I mentioned that there are a lot of men better known in the community than they are in their own family circle. A woman came up to me afterwards and said, you must have been talking about my husband. And she gave the name of her husband, and I knew him very well, and he's a prominent man in the city of Milwaukee. And she said, one day, a man came over to our house and said to one of our two boys, you have a rather famous father, a marvelous man. And one of the sons said, that's what I hear. He didn't know it from any association, but that's what I hear. Some of you have read the life, I'm sure, of David Livingstone, the great missionary to Africa. Remarkable person. The things he did, the courage he had, is just simply astonishing. Really the first great missionary to Africa. Utterly fearless. When he landed at a certain spot and the natives pulled back their arrows, poison arrows, he walked right up to them and pushed them aside. When it came to where the ponds infested with animals, he'd walk right through it. Utterly without fear. And his own father-in-law tells, Moffat was his father-in-law, missionary, said that he was troubled with tonsillitis, Dr. Livingstone. Livingstone handed him the scissor and said, would you please cut them out? This is, Moffat said he couldn't do it. But the same kind of hardness was revealed towards his family. There's a book, I can't recall it, but it's a very thorough life of Livingstone, in which his wife died while they were there. Almost unhuman the way he treated her. She was pregnant, and they were traveling in Africa, the most difficult conditions and circumstances. And he was a medical doctor. And you can read his report on his wife, just so he's reporting on anybody. It doesn't make any difference. No warmth, no feeling. He gives temperature and chart and so on, progress and so on. And she died. And one of the saddest notes that I read in his life was where he dug the grave himself, buried his own wife. And oft we longed to live together, he said, in England, but it was never to be. This is about the only time he showed any sentiment. That's the most he ever showed. He had several children. One of his daughters wrote that my uncle meant more to me than father, because we were scared of him. And he sent me from Africa a dark-skinned doll. I threw it in the corner, never used it. But when he came and visited us, the family stayed in England. But when he came to visit us, I'd take it out. He said, "What?" She said, "What did I want with the dark doll?" He had a son that had heard all of the greatness of his father, but he didn't know his father. But he longed to be near his father. So he ran away at the age of about 14 to Africa to try to locate his father. Just imagine a 14-year-old boy getting on a ship and running away to Africa. And he didn't have the slightest idea. Fortunately, his mother, the mother-in-law of David Livingstone, was very kind to the boy and took care of him and sent him back home to England. But before he got back, he was shanghaied to America. And when he woke up in the United States, he found he'd enlisted on the north side of the north. He knew nothing about it. Woke up a soldier in the north, which was not uncommon, as you know, on that day. He fought in the war, 14, 15 years of age. He's now in the hospital. He's sick, lonely, homesick, 14, 15 years of age. And this is the letter he wrote to his father. This will give you an idea how a minister can be so right to the point, sacrificial, orthodox to the letter. My dear sir, this is the way he addresses the letter to his father. Imagine your son addressing you as dear sir. Hearing that you have returned to England, I undertake to address a few lines to you. Listen to this. Not with any hope that you will be interested in me. Not pathetic. But simply, he says, to explain my position. The agent of MacArthur, Port Natal, said that he would write to him and inform him of my position and find me employment till I could find means to reach you. Mr. Rutherford, collector of His Majesty's Customs at Port Natal, interested himself in me for your sake and treated me with kindness. I believe that I owe some obligations to Mr. MacArthur. All he heard of me was that I was to come out on a certain vessel. Concluding that I'd run away, he would have nothing to do with me. I should have been very badly off if it had not been for the kindness of Mrs. Robert Moffat, that's the mother-in-law of David Livingstone, to whom, beside, I owe a great deal, perhaps more than I shall ever be able to repay. From Port Natal, I went to Cape Town, where your agent, Mr. Rutherford, advised me to find employment on board a brig which brought me to Boston, America. Here I was kidnapped one morning, and after going to bed on board ship, I found myself enlisted in the United States Army. I've been in one battle and two skirmishes and expect to be in another terrific battle before long. God, in His mercy, has spared me as yet. I've never hurt anyone knowingly in battle, have always fired high, and in that furious madness which accompanies a bayonet charge and which seems to possess every soldier, I controlled my passion and took the man who surrendered prisoner. If you know anything about soldiering, you know a man becomes almost like an animal with a bayonet, and he's taught to scream, yell, and charge just like a wild animal. The rebels are not likely to hold out much longer, as we have nearly all of their railroads. My craving for travel is not yet satisfied, though if I had the chance that I threw away of being educated, I should think myself only too much blessed. Listen to this. I have changed my name. For I am convinced that to bear your name would lead to further dishonor to it. I am at present in this hospital, exposure and fatigue, having given me fever.
and he died in the hospital, 15 years age, in the United States. When Father David Livingston got notice of his son's death, he just quietly said, well, he's now in the hands of the Heavenly Father. Pretty cold. Yet, he could preach the gospel. He could preach it like no one could to these natives. He fought slavery. God uses us all in mysterious ways, but I'm just pointing it out to you, fellow pastors, how many times ministers, kids, have had a rough time because their parents have neglected them. The parents have loved everybody else but their own children. He that does not provide for his own, says the Bible, is worse than an infidel. And your own is your own family circle and your own group and your own kids. Give them love. And don't let the parishioners spoil them either. They do their worst. They can be as bad as anybody. I can remember when I lived in Eau Claire and two of my children were small. There was one merchant there that whenever my kids went in there, he'd give them 10 cents. And of course, they went in there quite often and they found that out. And I finally had to tell them, stop it. Don't do that. I don't want my children to be treated any different. If you give dime to all children, okay. But I don't want my children to be treated any different than any others. I have to chuckle when my oldest daughter was quite an extrovert, who, when she was about 10, got in a fight with some other neighboring girl. And the other girl says, you can't fight, you got to be good, you're a minister's daughter. My daughter came home and says, why do I have to be good? Because I'm a minister's daughter. Well, I think the community has much of that, and you who are minister's children could probably add to this a great deal in the larger bonnet. To become a person apart from their parents, oftentimes ministers' kids have become tough, hard-boiled, deliberately gone against what their parents taught or believed in, because they wanted to become an identity separate from their parents. And when I was in Minneapolis, I often counseled ministers' children. I recall one minister's daughter was a prostitute in Minneapolis, and who had troubles in her own conscience, and I said, didn't you ever talk to your father about your problems here in the city? Oh, she said, he isn't a bit interested in me, she said, and he wouldn't know what I was talking about if I told him of the temptations of the city. It doesn't mean anything. She says, when I go home, I don't even go to church. I said, I think you should go to church. I said, I think you're staying away just to sort of get even with him. But I said, you should be above that now. But this incident too had a very happy ending, because I eventually did unite her in marriage with a fine young man. But may I emphasize again, don't let the congregation run you. They'll run you ragged if you give them a chance. They'll make you work 12 hours a day and 7 days a week, and if you put on two services, they'll want three. If you put three, they'll want four. Have a certain independence. And along the same breath, may I say to you, men, take care of your health physically. Exercise, fresh air, sunshine. Play golf, fish, hunt. We're not spirits floating around in the air. We're physical creatures. We need that exercise. First, years of my ministry, I thought to be dedicated. I had to work long hours and get up early, which I didn't study. I didn't play games, exercise. Then there came a time when I had to take 6 months off to recover my health. And I got some sense in my thick skull, and from that time on, I have exercised a great deal. Played handball 3 times a week for 25 years. Played tennis, golf, and I don't ever tell you, but I was on the Northwest Championship volleyball team because it would be hardly evident in Washington. But I can show you the picture of our team winning the Northwest Championship of Minneapolis and Chicago and the whole area. But I did it not only for teaching me a lot about other people, but exercise. So that now in Chicago one time at the Ladies' Aid, I had a golf game and I had to open the Ladies' Aid and I said, I'm sorry, ladies, I got to leave you. I have 18 committal services.
Ha 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 ha
Well, when you're open and with a pinch of humor, most of them like it and love it and have no compunctions about asking how's your golfer and so on. But when I began my ministry, I would never let them see me go out the door with golf clubs or golf clothes. The neighbors, very wonderful people across the street, they knew every time I played golf. I don't know how they found out, but they made I looked happier on those occasions. But exercise, fresh air, sunshine. Back about 20 years ago, just a minute, I was going to finish this, about 20 years ago at Minneapolis, at one of our conventions in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, a friend of mine was with me, a businessman. We walked around among the preachers. He said, you know what I think about you ministers? He said, you're a sickly lot. He said, most of these men do not look healthy. I don't think that would be so true now as it was at that time. Because if you wanted to look pious, look sickly, the two went together. Bruce?
Gavin Nelson,
Kirby Osborne,
Gavin Nelson, Kirby
I think it's true, most of us the same. Somebody else raised their hand over here, I thought I saw.
Turnier was so helpful here. He said he was often asked why he would make people wait up to a month to see him. And he said, if I'm always available, then I'm not worth enough when I am available.
That's very good.
And
yeah, that's very good. Anyone else? Any comments in this area?
I wonder if part of this doesn't fall in line with this business of being honorable that you were talking this morning too. I can't help but feel that our people have a little hard time buying some of our advice on how they should conduct their families when they see that we're not doing this ourselves. When we stand in the pulpit and tell fathers to spend time with their children and then they know that we ourselves are tied down 7 days a week. I think this is destroys all your preaching.
It does. Yes, I know looking over my life I can see how I could have been much better in my relationship with my kids. Too oftentimes I was too busy, too occupied. Once in Chicago, when I first came there, I had a minister's meeting in the Sherman Hotel, and I went in the wrong room. I went into a room and there were a lot of men sitting there, and I just saw an empty chair and pulled it up and got started eating, and found out it wasn't the pastor's meeting at all. That was in some other place. And I explained to the boy, he said, stay here. We're a group of businessmen. We have a meeting. It isn't too important.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, you stay and glad to have you. And so I just told him I'm a Lutheran minister. And they told me many interesting things as we got going around the circle table. But one of the most interesting was one of the men said to me, I was very much interested in politics here in Chicago and it looked like a good future. And he said, I also have a very fine business. But he said, I suddenly became ill and I was thrown in the hospital, a mild heart attack. And he said, I was very angry at the thought that I was thrown in the hospital. And he said, I laid there and I was irritated. And the first few weeks was a job to relax. He said, then I started reading newspapers. I got sick of that. He said, I looked at TV, he said. I got sick and tired of that. And he said, then pretty soon, he said, I began to think. It took that long before he could arrive at that point. Then he said, I began to think about my life. And I began to think about my family and my sons. And he said, I remember how much I'd promised my sons I'd spend time with them. Always in the future, I'm going to get the business straightened out, and it's political business. But he said, down deep, I knew I never would. And he said, I finally arrived at a very peaceful attitude towards life. I called my wife and children, and I said, now I'm going to set aside a certain night every week, which will be your night. I will do on that night what you people plan, and nothing will ever interfere with that plan. And he said, I've kept it ever since, and it's one of the happiest things I've ever done in my life. He said, if nothing else, the Lord threw me on the bed there to start to think in this relationship. I wonder if all of us don't need something similar to shake us up.
We have a family night, usually it's a Friday evening. But it's amazing how much this means to the children, especially our youngest. If something were to come up the family night, this would be a heartbreaker.
Is that so? You mean with you and your children?
Right. We do something as a family.
One of the delightful things I came into was up in Minnesota. I was speaking up there and stayed at a home. And there were six children, little tots up, and then there were some up to about high school. And when it came to the end of the meal, the man at the head of the table said, Pastor, we have the practice in our family that each one will tell the most interesting thing he has seen and heard during the day. We're going to include you also. Well, man, I just questioned, what have I seen today? And it was really interesting because this little tot, one told about a tree he liked so much. And in other words, all little things that they'd seen. And when the one person had the center of the stage, everybody listened. And on to the next. Each one knew he'd have his turn. This took 1 hour. It was one of the fastest hours I've ever seen. That was really a family circle. I wonder if something of that couldn't be recovered. We've got this crazy notion, of course, to be busy, that you aren't successful unless you're busy. If you can be on a little dog trot all the time, then you really are successful. Can you imagine Jesus patting a child on the head with one hand and catching the time of the day with the other? This is pretty much of what is the danger of our being so endlessly busy. I think of the story, I'm sure you've heard it, of the minister who was asked one January to give a speech next June. So he pulled out his date book and looked at it. He said, no, I can't. He said, I have a funeral that day. That's close scheduling.
I find this most interesting, being a PK myself. In our own family, I think this is something that refers my dad being with us, that, for instance, now I'm sure that if I was in Madison, he was up in Elroy, Wisconsin, and I, no matter how busy it was, unless of course it was something scheduled like a funeral or a wedding or something like this, he'd always fit in something. I'd say, let's go golfing. Even if he didn't have a sermon prepared, because he probably could do that later on. And this is something that's always gone on with our family. And if we suggested something, he was more than willing to do it as long, if there wasn't something specifically scheduled.
which I felt was something that gave us a closer relationship.
I'm surprised you want to play golf with your dad because he's one of the best in the whole church body.
I haven't been yet.
I can see why you're so eager to play golf. I'll show that kid.
I can remember when my son hit a ball farther than mine, and boy jumped up and down and leaped in one of the happiest moments in his life. Any other comment here? How about the wives, ministers' wives? Do they have the time to rear their kids the way they should? Are they on one pedestal? A minister's wife came to me once, passed in a small community, who dressed very nicely, choice clothes. She says, I feel terribly embarrassed. I'm afraid that women are eyeing me all the time. I said, don't stop. You like nice clothes and you're not extravagant. Keep it up. Don't stop. I presume in some communities it would be rather difficult.
Ministers, I think nowadays they kind of appreciate that. They like to look upon the wife as at least being fairly up with styles within the past 5 years in a way, rather than maintaining some ancient dowdy effect.
I think of two women who hadn't seen each other for 10 years. One said to the other, you know, I wouldn't have known you, you've gotten so fat. The other one said, I wouldn't have known you either, except for the hat you're wearing.
You got to practice to get those remarks, you know.
You might be interested, back about 15 years ago, I wrote a letter to ministers and district presidents, to the wives of the ministers, not the ministers, asking, does your husband know how to live? And I had a whole sheet of questions, and I said, do not sign any name. And when they returned to me, I didn't open the letters. I had my secretary take them. I did not want to know the town they came from, because I might read something into it that wasn't there. But it was amazing to read all these statements. Does your husband take time to read? What is it? Does he study? Does he travel? Does he? How much time does he spend on a sermon? Is he optimistic? Is he a duality of personality? Is he one thing at home, one thing there? It was most interesting to observe how many of the wives seemed afraid to enter into any criticism of their husbands. Most of them thought their husbands, as far as being preachers, were perfect. That their husbands were the best. Maybe that's the way it should be, I don't know. What do you think? My wife has always been a pretty good critic and would correct me on mistakes and errors, but I think she's overly sympathetic. I think she's a little bit too generous. But I made a mistake once in the sermon that she was the only one that caught it. And I'll wager most of you here wouldn't catch it. I'll tell it to you. It was about signs, about our Graham Bell invented the telephone. Graham Bell needed some money to get the thing on the market. And so he went to the leading scientist of the day, who was head of Western Union. I can't recall his name now, I think it was Marston. Anyway, I went to him and said, I jumped ahead of my story. He went, Graham Bell went to Chauncey Depew, who was then president of the New York Railroad and one of the wealthiest men in the United States, asking him for about $25,000 to help launch the telephone. And Chauncey Depew went to the leading scientists, and he said, I don't know anything about this business, about science. And Marston said, it's only a plaything. It'll never amount to a thing. Don't throw your money away in anything like that. Telegraph is the thing that counts, he said. So Chauncey Depew decided not to. That evening, Graham Bell went to see Chauncey Depew. And Marston, the scientist, was so afraid that Chauncey Depew wouldn't listen to his advice that he called him up and said, look here, don't put it away. That was the slip. Telling it what he did is he came and called on Chauncey Depew, but I said he called him. And there was no telephone in which to call him up. So it is good to have a wife that can correct you to these things. And then we develop, oftentimes as ministers, mannerisms in our preaching. G. Studdard Kennedy, the chaplain to the king after World War I, who wrote the poem Christ of Birmingham, and a remarkable poet, and a man. He was the popular man after World War I. He spoke all up and down our country. I heard him in Milwaukee speak to a huge youth conference. But the strangest mannerisms of any man I had ever seen. He would twist his hair when he was talking. And his clothes, he'd go like this when he's talking. And one time he turned his back completely on the audience and went over to a light fixture and worked on it while he was talking. Two or 3,000 people out there. Well, he could get by with it because he was, I suppose, famous.
He had to hold their attention. Somewhere.
Yeah. Well, he was a great poet and he read his poems to us and so on. But watch out for mannerisms that are easy to slip into. I had a mannerism once of twisting my ear when I was preaching, without knowing I got into that habit. Some get in the habit pulling their noses, you know. Some have a cross that keeps spinning while they're talking. And if you're twirling the cross. If you're a big man physically, watch out for leaning over there. You're going to be the Newfoundland dog. You're going to lean over and be cozy with this congregation. We can slip into these mannerisms quite easily without being aware of it. So critic is a good thing. When I was in Eau Claire, the choir director had Edwin Howard, a marvelous person, graduate of Harvard University, fine musician, and had been in Grand Opera. And as a boy, I'd heard Phillips Brooks' picture. He said to me, would you object if I made some suggestions and corrections? Well, I told him I'd be happy to. And all while I was in Eau Claire, he, on Monday, told me, here is a mistake you made. Here is a mispronounced word. Here's a transition that was poor. When I got to Milwaukee and my congregation there, and if you go to Milwaukee Ascension Lutheran Church, you'll find one of the leading members is a high school teacher named Josephine Lane. Wonderful person. And highly educated, cultured. And I appointed her as my critic. I said, any mistakes and blunders I make, would you please tell them to me? Any error in quotation, I'd be happy to get them. And all while I was there, she was a very helpful critic. And I spoke at the anniversary of the church at Eau Claire. I said, if the Lutheran Church allows polygamy, Josephine, I'm going to invite you to join my harem. a critic is a very important thing, and if the minister's wife can serve in this capacity, she can be most helpful. Any comment here? You men don't dare to say anything.
I think most of the time they're too gracious. I don't think I think we need to help them, encourage them to be more critical if we can take it.
The last thing I want my wife to say to me is the sermon was too long. If that's the only way it's going to be measured by its length, then there's something wrong. And ministers' wives, I've heard it again and again. I've heard pastors' wives say, you preached too long today. Well, there ought to be more to the sermon. If she'd say a couple of good thoughts there, but you could have spent less time on one of them. This would be a little bit more love in it than just sitting there with a stopwatch. Maybe it's a good thing, too, to have that sharp criticism and length. As we get older, we get windier. I've observed in ministers over the years, there are about four different stages. One is 25 to 35. The other is 35 to 50, the other is 50 to 65, and then from 65 on. It's interesting to observe ministers when they come to ordination. How many were ordained within the last 10 years? Anyone? In the last five? Anybody in 5 years? It's a long time ago since I was ordained by Dr. Stubb. And I can remember his sermon. And I can remember him saying to the congregation, don't clip the wings of this young man. And they never did. And that I owe so much to Grace Lutheran Church in Eau Claire. They let me try out my wild ideas and put up with my stupidity and mistakes and blunders and still love me. It's a wonderful thing to do that. That we come out of the seminary as a rule, fresh, eager, with a spiritual glow. I read an article in Christian Century some time ago in which it said, the seminary kills the spiritual glow of the student. He gets so steeped in theology that he loses his contagious enthusiasm for Jesus Christ. Do you think this is true or don't you? That we emphasize the intellectual. Somebody raise their hand. Bruce, did you?
Well, I think it's too much of a generalization.
Yeah.
Too broad.
Yeah, I think there's something good about seminary. It's something terribly exciting.
Well, when I was there, we didn't have enough theology, really. It was the other type, emphasis, tenor, and that type.
Oh, yeah. Well, why is it that today, in our seminary, 70% of the graduates do not intend to stay in parish ministry? I'm on the Board of Regents of Wartburg Theological Seminary. Half of the class, a couple of years ago, did not plan to stay in parish ministry. Most of them said they wanted to be professors, teachers, or in some branch of the church, but not parish ministry. How do you account for that?
I read some statistics in this regard that really disturbed me greatly, and that was that 32% of the seminary graduates are agnostics. Now, I don't know how accurate these statistics are, but nevertheless, there must be a semblance of truth there. How can a person be called and complete the seminary course and then become...
Is this all American seminaries, or is it, or what is it?
American seminaries.
Is it just Lutheran?
No, I don't even know what denomination this pertains to. I think it was a generalization regarding...
There's a lot of people go for the seminary for theological training, which helps them in other areas, and they have no pretense, and they aren't admitted under any idea that they will enter a parish ministry.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of graduate work and so on.
Yeah, my thoughts were how horrible this would be to take 32% of the seminary graduates, assign them to churches, and then let them be responsible for the souls of people so far as material and education and inspiration is concerned, and not have them at all sold on what they're attempting to sell. That could be a real blow to the Church of America.
I think it's possible for a pastor to be a practical atheist, to live for all practical purposes like God didn't exist.
Go through the machinery of it. Actually, people, as you know, are familiar with your church history. This was much more common in the days gone by than it is now, and in Europe. Charles Darwin's father, you know, wanted him to be a minister, and he planned to go to the ministry.
Hmm.
Father was an atheist, but he said this is a pleasant way of living. And he said, go into that. And Charles Darwin had planned to, but he took a trip to Africa, which started him along the line of science. And so he abandoned the idea. But this was characteristic of Europe, that many of, in the days of Charles Wesley, the most immoral people were the clergy. Because it was purely a professional thing. So today I think the standard is higher, but I think, speaking of 30% agnostic, it depends on who's collecting the statistics.
Yeah.
Conservative might think some people, because they have liberal viewpoints, are agnostics. But what I'm saying, mostly here in the parish ministry, I think a lot of the young fellows are scared of the parish ministry. And we who are in the parish ministry have not sold it well enough. The joy of it and the fun of it and the satisfactions of the parish. I wouldn't trade my parish ministry work for a professor for any job that I can give. the satisfactions are tremendous that come in the ministry, as you men know. But I remember hearing a student at preach a sermon in a certain town, and he was a senior at the seminary, and I wrote him a letter afterwards and said, I liked your sermon very much. I got a great deal out of it, and I was inspired by the good things you said. A year later, he was ordained into the ministry, and his father wrote me and said, my son is going into the parish ministry because of a letter you wrote to him. He felt that he was not good enough or qualified, and he was afraid of the parish ministry. But your letter reassured him that he did have something to say and is going into it. And I think many times we who are in the parish ministry fail to sell the students on the joy of being a parish.
Well, there's a parallel, of course, that I think maybe all of us are aware of, that that there aren't very many positions that are choosing to be a country doctor or a small town doctor anymore, or what do you call them, a general practitioner. There may be a swing that way, but I would suppose most of them want to be a skilled something or other and a specialist, you know, and I wonder if this isn't just about the way it is all along the line in many, many areas, not maybe can be identified other places in our society too.
There is a good article in McCall's magazine about a month back, Danger Hospitals, and it's about doctors and what goes on in the hospital, a lack of care coming up because of over-specialization.
Well, I could make a generalization. There's only two interns now that we've had in our church in Portland, and both of them are just as different as can be and from different communities too. Different backgrounds, totally. And I haven't, neither one of them are under my suspect, along the line of agnostic or even the matter, nobody's knocked the idea of the joy of the parish either. Now, one of them is going to be a general, Luther General in Chicago next year, but I'm dead positive he'll find his way into the parish. I don't think that's got anything to do with it. He just didn't, he was kind of afraid of people, didn't want to get in a counseling situation when he was in an internship. And probably got an opportunity where he went. In fact, I've heard all these things and wondered, you know, so I started feeling these guys out. How about it now? What do you see here? You can kind of get bruised and booted around here a little, but both of them are pretty stiff Midwest stuff, and they come through and let them have it. I mean, in personal encounters in the council, for instance, in committee meetings and one thing or another. One we have this year, I think he surprised himself in how strong-willed he finds out he is. And people accept it.
Yeah.
They like him better that way.
Here's a question. Don't you think this anti-parish idea for many of the men are put in the minds of the men in college, that so many of them major in either religion or philosophy, and that they're told right from the beginning, well, you really should go into something more challenging in the parish ministry. I've heard some of our faculty in the religion department sort of influence the fellows that, well, yeah, you can go on through the STEM and graduate, but of course you'll only stay in the ministry for a short time. And it seems to me if this seed is planted for 4 years in college, it becomes rather difficult for them, even on their internship, to have it change.
I think that's added to it, seminary too, by the critique of the parish, is going on now. It really has a healthy element to it, but I think there are a lot of things being written and spoken about giving up on the parish.
That's just the name of the game. That's just a little fun now, you know. There'll be something new
just
coming
up.
That's about run itself out.
But then you add to that the glamour of the Peace Corps and a lot of other new kinds of organizations springing up, which draw
Martin here.
It was interesting, 11 years ago when I graduated from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, about 75% of the class just automatically went into, you know, the parish ministry. And they pointed out that this year now, 11 years later, it's down to about 60% into the parish ministry. But one thing I noticed
then and now, is that the vast bulk of those who go on for graduate work usually go on just for a master's, and over 80% of those then go into the parish ministry. That while, you know, out of a class of 400 or 500, it may seem a lot to have 25 go on for the teaching profession, it really isn't that great. And I also noticed in just glancing over the assignments, very few assignments were multiple parishes to little towns, and I think the seminaries are wising up now and giving better calls, more challenging calls to the young men, instead of having the graduate or the candidate feel that, you know, his purgatory now commences at his first call, and they're challenging them with more meaningful calls, and the district presidents are, you know, putting them in better positions, better places, or fitting the situation to the man. Why send an intellectual, you know, to Bedrock, Montana, when there's maybe not even a library for 300 miles around? We don't fit the place with the man. And maybe, I know when everybody's scared to death of their first call, because you just know it's the end of the world. And a lot of that's folklore, of course, but much less today than others. So maybe, you know, the district presidents in all the churches could be more aware of this and get the younger men in,
at the time of the graduate seminar,
associate positions and things like this that would challenge him and fit the man to the place more than, you know, well, we've got X number of vacancies, we've got X number of candidates, we're only glad now that we can put him in the field.
Yeah, but Marty, if you have that kind of general idea, and then there's a kind of a looking down on Bedrock, Montana, there's something wrong with that too.
No, I think that oftentimes a rural parish or a small parish has greater challenges, but we haven't always matched the man, you know, to the parish situation. He's a new candidate, consequently, he goes to Bedrock, Montana.
Well, I see your point.
We maybe need to close a lot of these small places and not just keep them going with candidates every 3 years.
I understand you there.
Because it used to be that the vast bulk of them went to very small churches in, you know, very dying communities.
Yes, when we begin the ministry, 25, 30, we have a spiritual glow. I can go to Claire now and remember the names of most of those people, as you perhaps can in your first parish. You're very gracious, you smile more, you remember names, and you do all those little extra gracious things to remember them. I think I was through Eau Claire not long ago, and I met a man on the street. I was dressed something like this, and the fellow stopped me and says, "Say," he said, "you look a lot like Reverend Yorkton." I said, "Others have told me the same thing." We have to be careful as a young minister that the spiritual glow is a spiritual glow, not just youthful energy or sudden discovery that we have power and authority. I remember the shock when I first met with the board. I was the reverend. I was only 23 years of age. And here these men, I'm the leader. It is quite disturbing. We may like the word reverend. We might like the word pastor. There was a way, but at that time, when I came out, not to use the word reverend. That didn't apply, it wasn't correct, and so on. So when I answered the phone, I'd say, "This is Mr. Yorkland." They'd hang up for a chance to explain. They thought it was the wrong number. And that name of mine would throw them anyhow. H.J., they couldn't get that straight. So then I just said, "This is the minister." And then finally said, "Is this the reverend?" "This is the reverend." So then I don't care what they call me. So I just kept using reverend. Now, to maintain that spiritual glow, young man, for all of us, I suggest a lot of reading. Read history. I take 20 different magazines. Some of them extremely liberal, some of them wild-eyed, some of them conservative. And as you know, as you read, you get familiar with the style and the pattern of books, magazines, and so on. So you can read more rapidly than you can at the start with any particular book or magazine, but read constantly. And here is an important thing to remember. Use wisely your broken fragments of time. The ministry consists of many broken fragments. We don't have 9 to 5. There are many interruptions. I've learned to carry with me books, magazine articles, wherever I am. Even when I go to the funeral, there's a magazine in my pocket. I may be delayed at the funeral home for 15, 20 minutes. I go in the corner and read. Plane, train, railroad station. It's astonishing how much you can accomplish in those broken fragments of time. My wife and I are driving along. She'll often read to me something of interest, or I will read to her. We'll compare notes as we're discussing it. But endless reading, how important it is. And get the joy of reading. You can go into some ministers' libraries and there isn't a book that's been printed in the last 20, 30 years. They haven't read anything probably since they finished the seminary. I remember one minister said to me, what do you do all that reading for? You got the Bible, what more do you need? It said of Jesus, he knew what was in the minds of men. Unless we're going to, if we're going to find out what's in the minds of men, we have to read and contact people, listen, observe, endlessly, have a point of curiosity. The object of the minister anyway is to bring the will of God and the will of man together. All I think of my function is I introduce people to Jesus Christ, then he takes care of the rest of it. Be careful that you don't stand in the way of that introduction. Very easy for ourselves to be think we've got to defend Jesus Christ and not present him. This is what E. Stanley Jones said when he had his breakdown to begin with in India. He said, I was trying to defend Jesus Christ instead of presenting him. And he said, now I present him. He said, I don't try to defend him by any arguments or proving he's divine or anything. He said, I just present him. This is a hard lesson to learn. When Shalyapin, the great Russian singer, had his picture painted, it showed him favoring his right knee. But he didn't. There was no trouble with his right knee. But the artist who painted his picture was suffering from gout at the time and had a bad right knee. And he painted his right knee into Shalyapin. And I wonder if sometimes we don't do the same thing with Jesus Christ. We paint our personalities into him. This is one of the reasons so many boys and young men have a feminine conception of Jesus, a feminine conception. They've had women Sunday school teachers and sometimes effeminate preachers. And so the masculinity of Jesus is not apparent. When I was a chaplain in the army, a sermon I preached many times was the manliness of Jesus. And I found it appealed more than any other sermon I spoke to these men. And one Sunday afternoon, I remember several high-ranking officers came to me and said, we heard your sermon, and we did talking among ourselves, we felt that it was our duty to come and thank you for preaching this sermon to our men. The manliness of Jesus should be evident. So watch out so we don't paint our personalities into it, or the irritations of the past week, or something we're sore about gets into the sermon, or we take a crack at somebody. We've got a terrific position up the pulpit, they can't answer us back. It's a very easy and very dangerous thing. To maintain the spiritual goal, read, read, read. Go to school. Since I finished the seminary, I've studied any number of summers at Union Theological Seminary, Chicago Theological Seminary, and I've traveled a great deal. Borrowed money, mortgaged my car, bought secondhand furniture so we could live cheaper, pulled in money wherever I could, saved on a number of things. As a result, I've been to Europe 6 times, around the world 3 times, been to school many times. I often wonder where the money was coming from, but it can be done. And you'll find members of your church will be interested in it, too, in doing it, and seeing that you do it. Don't sponge on your members financially, I'm not saying that. I had a man in my church in Milwaukee, a very wealthy man. I went to him one day and I said, I'll often need in the ministry while I'm here. $500, $300, $1,000. I want to be able to come to you and say, I need that money right now. And I'll sign a note for it, but I don't want you ever to cancel the bill. This is a note, and I want to pay. If you cancel it out and say, forget it, then I can't do what I want to do. Then I feel always obligated to you. And all while I was in Milwaukee, this man, I could go to him anytime, call him up, $300, $500, $1,000, and I take a trip to Europe. I need $2,000. And I paid every cent of it back again. This is very valuable. Money can come and does come. I wonder sometimes if we ministers aren't a bit careless in the use of our money and couldn't be a little bit more economical and more useful in it, improving ourselves constantly. It has paid back to me dividends. I've got all the money back many times over. Money has been the least of my worries in the ministry. I can go out and make speeches if I want to. General Motors was after me to go out and just speak, just as one of my friends does, who speaks for Carl Winters. He speaks all the time, gets so much a week, $1,000 a week, goes out and speaks for General Motors. Doesn't advertise General Motors, he just goes to teachers, conventions, and groups, but they pay his expenses, bottom of the program, this speaker by the courtesy of General Motors. They have three or four men. I was offered a position once to do that with him. Money has been the least of my worries, and yet I've had to borrow many times. This is not boasting, but anybody can do the same thing if he's willing to do it. Improve yourself. Never be satisfied. Never think you've arrived. Never think you've come to a point in life, now you're good. You older ministers know, the moment you think you're pretty good, you fall flat on your face and make a jackass out of yourself. You never arrive. There are two points in life when a man thinks he's arrived. One is when he's about 20 or thereabouts. He thinks he knows everything because he knows nothing. And a man gets to be 45, he thinks he knows everything because he does know something.